Hey, I had a meetup in DC last night and like 15 people showed up. It was a nice big deal.
It looked amazing. And you were at my favorite bar in DC, the Tune In.
I did that tip of the hat to you, Justin, because I was thinking I've not lived in DC now long enough. I don't know where you bring a big group of people anymore. Like a lot of the places I used to go to shut down. And I know the Hawk and Dove, which I used to go to, is like really gussied up.
Yeah.
Like it used to be the place that you could get like $6 whiskey gingers and dollar tacos, which we were talking about this. Dollar tacos are far more off-putting than free tacos. Free tacos is a gimmick. Dollar tacos implies very low overhead on the tacos. Questionably low overhead.
Yeah, dollar tacos builds in the concept of neglect.
Yes, exactly. But that used to be Hawk and Dove, but I'm told Hawk and Dove's really gussied up. And then you had mentioned the Tune In, and I was like, Oh, right, the Tune In. I never hung out there when I was on the Hill. That was like the old lobbyist bar, but I now look like an old lobbyist. And I was also like, if there's one place you can count on to be just an eye of the storm of a dive bar in this world, it is the Tune In. So we met there. We all hung out outside. Somebody listens to my show in high school. There was a high school, it might have been a college student. I don't know. Everybody looks really young to me now, but there was a young person there.
Yeah, thank God that there was seating outside, because as I remember the Tune In, it is essentially a hallway that is mostly bar and then a bathroom at the very end. That is pretty much the entirety of the Tune In. So if you had a gathering of 15 people, thank God they had set up folding chairs outside.
I will say that there was a lot of talk about us doing a live show in DC. That was something that people very much enjoyed the idea of. And so if we ever want to do a live show in DC, just the Heaton crew, I can bring at least 15 people.
If there are a few places for which I believe we will be able to just turn out a crowd. New York's one of them. DC's one of them. Austin obviously is another one. It'll happen. Probably sooner rather than later. We got to figure that out. Did you get any stragglers of the debt ceiling wars? Like, that is a place in which professional DC people drink. And this is, I can imagine, a pretty salty week on the Hill. This is a Hill bar. There's got to be a lot of people pissed off that they're canceling their Memorial Day weekend plans.
Well, for only half the Congress doesn't care. They're like, we're staying on vacation.
Oh, yeah. No, the Senate is like, whatever. Well, no, they still might have to come back to pass something, right?
Maybe. But like right now, they're not planning to. They're just planning on default. It's like, oh, we have our vacations. We don't care. We're so old that we don't care about the future of the United States. So fuck it. Let's go vacay.
So no stragglers?
There was a staffer from the Hill that was fun, because I was able to talk to him and be like, hey, what's happening over here now? Like, is that, you know, is the bourbon I left under the desk in the conference room still there? Like kind of like catching up on the, you know, 10-15 year gap. But we were talking about other things. Like, he met George Santos, and we were talking about George Santos and how charming that man is. And it was great. It was fun time.
So wait, do you have Santos stories that you can share, or were they in confidence?
No. They were. It was pretty much exactly what I said. He's like, I had to talk to the guy, and he took a beat, and he's like, and I felt like I had the most genuine, real conversation with him, and he was just charming. And I was like, this, because I'm the old staffer talking to the current young buck. I was like, I feel like the leprous king in Braveheart, where he knows that Santos is a scumbag, but he's so charming. And I'm like, oh, now you're ready to rule. You know, like you know going in that he's not a good guy, but you're going to like him and you can make peace with it.
Oh, that is amazing. No, we got to do a DC thing. DC, yeah. That's really where we need to do a thing. I don't know. I'll start looking into it.
Yeah. It's like the mothership calling us home.
No. Mm-hmm. Wait, you think we could get Howard Mortman on stage?
Actually,
can we get Howard Mortman just to be our MC? I think that would be amazing.
Howard Mortman as the hype man.
DC might be the place where, like, DC is literally the place where we could, like, have a former Secretary of Education do a juggling routine, and it would bring down the house. People would be like, oh, my God, is that the head of OIRA? Jesus Christ, that's the head of OIRA. She juggles?
Oh, my God, wait. Do you think Grover Norquist could open?
Yes, I do. I will talk to him.
Grover Norquist could do a tight five.
Grover, well, and he also juggles. Like, he juggles. The first time I met Grover Norquist, it was really funny. We were doing an interview. This is way back when I'm just beginning all this stuff, right? And we were doing an interview. No one knows who I am. We sit down, we're on camera, and I go, Grover Norquist, I know why I hate Texas. Why do you hate Texas so much? And there's this long beat, and he goes, I hate taxes. And then the director goes, God damn it, Heaton, and cuts the whole thing. And I had to go, I know he hates taxes. This is just me being funny. And he was very nice about it. And we talked, and he was thrilled at one point that I was like, listen, I'm cool to talk to you about taxes and stuff, but I heard you can juggle. And like his face lit up and he's like, yes, do you want to see? And I was like, I would love to talk to you about stuff that's not taxes, thus beginning my decade long friendship with Grover Norquist, of me being the one guy that talks to him about not taxes. But yeah, he tried to teach me how to juggle. As we were leaving, he like rushed into the room with this like spoon on the nose trick he wanted to show me. So I think it's entirely possible Grover would do a variety show with us.
There is an alternate reality where you became the Colonel Tom Parker to his Elvis, as Grover Norquist did not become the boogeyman of the Obama administration, but rather a variety entertainer that captured America's heart.
He might well do. I want to say he was doing like an annual comedy show that he put together for DC Funny People. And then I think he's done like the DC Improv, which I haven't even done. So, yeah, that might be possible. I'll start. Let's all three of us start keeping lists of wonk people we know in DC that have human tricks that they could do, because maybe we could do like a variety show.
Oh, God. It'd be just so amazing. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From San Francisco, California,
I'm Jen Briney.
And from Washington, D.C.,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We will talk about social media and a advisory from the U.S. Surgeon General. Could it be the precursor to federal regulation? And skepticism from the Republicans negotiating the debt ceiling, that maybe this June 1st drop dead date isn't so drop dead datey at all. All that and your emails. Heaton, you had a meetup in DC. Do you ever feel like a pull back to DC, or is it like a little dabble? Do you? Like you're there, and then you're like, you want to know what? Maybe I'm happy that I left.
I definitely feel a pull, although particularly strongly this week. DC is absolutely lovely at this moment. It's like 40% humidity, 45% humidity in the morning, so it's just nice. It's nice. But then on top of that, I have a bunch of friends here. I used to work here. And then I was doing a sketch for Reason. I'm in town doing Reason sketches. And we were doing like a parody of a gender reveal. So I had a wife actress that was playing alongside me. So for a day, I was just on set doing comedy with some of my best friends with this wonderful wife. So I had this like alternate universe I got to step into here in Washington for a day, where I'm married to this hot blonde lady doing comedy and go outside and I don't sweat. Anyway, there's sometimes a pull there.
I don't know.
I'm aware if I moved here, I don't automatically get a hot blonde.
I was going to say, I don't know if that's funnier or sad.
It's sad. It's very sad.
Is it sad?
But,
okay.
But okay. Yeah, but yeah, no, that's, you know, if I were gonna move to another American city at this point, it'd probably be DC. It's a place I already know a bunch of people. I work in politics. There's a little bit of a pull there.
But also the summer blows.
But the summer only lasts 2 months as opposed to 9 months.
It's gorgeous still down here. I don't know what the hell you're talking about, man.
Justin, right now, no fooling. Yeah. Can you check what the humidity is in Austin, Texas?
The humidity. I honestly don't even know how you do that. How do you do that?
I mean, DC is pretty damn humid.
Yeah,
I've been
right.
There, so
yeah, it is.
No, because I have a very high tolerance for humidity, and there's only been a few American cities for which I've been like, Jesus, this humidity, and DC is one of them.
It's terrible in August and July. No argument there, but it's just July and August, as opposed to like Austin is, I think, an average of like 85% humidity in the morning. I am not tolerant to humidity, and I have to walk my dog every morning. So every morning I go outside and just immediately am coated in stickiness. I'm always moist. Like, if you know that word moist,
Yeah.
I'm just moist all the time when I go outside. What is it, like 85, 90% right now, Justin?
They're not reporting it.
They're not reporting it, yeah.
No, yeah. Sorry, they've decided not to report it on the president's orders. Mm-hmm. So
okay.
Yeah. It's 91. This week, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory about youth social media habits, identifying mental health as a key public health issue of our time. The key points from the advisory are as follows. 95% of American teenagers are reported to use at least one social media platform, with over a third of them using it almost constantly. In addition, close to 40% of 8 to 12-year-olds are regular users, despite most platforms having a minimum age requirement of 13. The document provides evidence of a correlation between intensive social media use and mental health issues among young people. There's been a nearly 30% increase in cases of depression and anxiety in children and adolescents in recent years. A study found that those spending more than 3 hours each day on social media are twice as likely to face mental health challenges. The advisory emphasizes the importance of adolescence in human brain development, with individuals between the ages of 10 and 19 being particularly susceptible to peer pressure. This period is critical in forming an individual's sense of self-worth when mental health issues such as depression often first emerge. Points out that social media use can be predictive of a decline in life satisfaction during these formative years. Attention is also given to the role of algorithms and the potential harm caused by certain content on social media platforms. Data from Meta, Facebook's parent company, indicates that 14% of teenage girls reported an increase in suicidal thoughts after using Instagram, and 17% claimed it exacerbated eating disorders. The advisory also acknowledges some benefits of social media use. Apps can provide a sense of community and connection, especially for marginalized groups such as LGBTQ plus youth, with a large number of users reporting that social media helps them feel more accepted and supported in challenging times. In response to these observations, the advisory urges action from a variety of stakeholders, including tech companies, policymakers, and parents, to foster a more supportive and safer online environment for young users. Policymakers in Montana recently banned the Chinese-owned social media app TikTok. TikTok is suing to overturn that decision. They say it is a violation of the First Amendment. That ban would go into place on January 1st. So we begin with you, Andrew Heaton, as you are on the Hill currently. Do you believe that these kinds of messages from the Surgeon General are a precursor for some kind of federal action that, at least by my reading, would seem to be bipartisan?
Not particularly. And for this reason, I read through the article you sent. I also skimmed through the Surgeon General's actual report that was an abbreviated form of. And I did not find anything that approached what I would call a policy recommendation. I found a general, our kids are in danger type thing, which I don't even disagree with, mind you, but that comes out fairly regularly. And I was like, well, I want to know what the federal government would do in response to this, because I'm genuinely not sure what you would do as the federal government to try to save kids from social media, what regulations you could put in place. I am open. So I looked through there, and what is the top thing that the Surgeon General recommends in the Surgeon General's report? Something to the effect of, we strongly urge local, state, and federal authorities to craft plans to protect children. Oh, thank you, Surgeon General, for coming up with that very specific. They should come up with a plan to protect children. Is that it? Good? I'm very glad we got you on the job. I don't think that there's a lot that could be done from a federal regulatory standpoint. I think what could happen and what might be efficacious is having recommendations for parents, who I think are ultimately going to be, if this is a problem, parents are going to be the gatekeepers on this and not the government. I don't think that the government's going to be able to craft regulations to protect children from social media. Parents might be able to institute things within their own home in terms of how much time you spend on your phone, whether we let you have a phone, being able to go through the apps and things like that. What the federal government could conceivably do, which it might be good at, is being able to put some data together and saying, hi, I, the Surgeon General, think, based on all of the data that I've gone through, that you shouldn't let your kid be on their phone more than 3 hours a day or something like that, right? I could see the Surgeon General's warning that we have for cigarettes and alcohol and things like that being a useful data metric or a point that parents have that, that might be propitious. But I'm not sure that there's much regulatory stuff that could come out of it. And I also, can I, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, let me just ask you this. Cigarettes and alcohol, when can you buy those?
When you're over 18 or 21, is that what you're talking about?
21, I think, for both now. I think they moved up the cigarette age in the dead of night, which I thought was weird.
But we can still send 18-year-olds off to die in foreign countries. I just want to be real parents, right? Oh, thank God.
The part of this legislation or part of this Surgeon General's warning is saying that from 10 to 19, it is a very, very specific time in brain development. To me, the number one thing that I could see for a legislative push would be for this kind of social media, algorithmically driven, advertisement forward social media. So maybe not messaging apps, which are can be more fostering of tiny communities. So maybe stuff like Discord or the messaging elements of WhatsApp or maybe even Snapchat or something like that. That is something that you could have a lower age limit on, but maybe it is making it illegal to have an account until you are 17 or 18.
I think that would be an extremely interesting thing to attempt to enforce. You're going to have, at the moment, as you point out, it's illegal to purchase alcohol or cigarettes prior to 21.
Yeah.
Noting that enforcement doesn't need to have 100% efficacy to be effective. That is good at keeping kids from having alcohol. It's not capable of keeping all kids from getting alcohol or all kids from getting cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
With social media, I suspect that that efficacy would be much, much lower. I think it would be very, very difficult to do that. I'm like between, let's say we just said, no kids under the age of 21 can look at porn. That's forbidden by law. It might in fact be the law right now. I don't know. I doubt that that is going to be how it works out. I think that ultimately the change is going to come from the home and the parents, much more likely than from federal legislators trying to outsmart kids with regulations on something that in this instance they're doing over their phone. They're doing on something that is usually anonymous, that is, you know, electronic, as opposed to going to a liquor store or going to a cigarette stand. Or cigarette emporium. I'm not sure where you get cigarettes. Cigarette. You know what? They brought cigarette machines back. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, they did. You have to put an ID in them, though. So there is a...
Really?
Yeah, if you go to High Noon in Austin, Justin, East Austin, they've got a cigarette machine, but you have to put in your ID, and it scans it, and then it coughs out the cigarettes.
Do you still pull the little pull cue?
I don't think so, unfortunately, because that was... There was one of those at the El Chico's that I went to as a kid. Like, the El Chico's just had a cigarette machine, like an Otter System cigarette machine in the lobby. Can I mention one other thing before we move on to the enforcement?
Let me turn it to Jen here real quick. Jen, what is your take on this? Do you believe that this could be a prelude to some sort of federal law? Because as Heaton points out, the only time that federal law gets made is when it's efficacious, and certainly not for any kind of emotional political reasons.
I actually do think legislation is coming, because after doing the Twitter files hearings and the TikToks and social media censorship episode, I mean, I've been watching these hearings for years and I've noticed two patterns. First of all, like, there's no chance that they're going to do anything like restricting it by age, because like Andrew said, like, all you have to do is pretend to be 18. You press the button and then you get into whatever website it is. So the enforcement is impossible. That's not even a conversation that I've heard in Congress. What I have heard, however, is data privacy protections, not just for kids, but for everyone, with the idea behind it being, if it's harder for these companies like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of them, to track children's behavior on the app. So like, one of the reasons that these kids will be getting stuff like, you know, this is how to kill yourself, is because they're being tracked. And so they're just trying to feed these kids more of what the algorithm thinks they want. If they're harder to track, it's harder to feed them stuff like that. So there's data privacy, not selling stuff to advertisers. And then the other thing I've witnessed is there's a lot of concern from experts that are talking to Congress about the algorithms, where they say that social media itself is not the problem, but the algorithms are the problem, because they're the ones that are deciding what the kids see. And a lot of times it's not to their benefit. It's to the benefit of these companies, that like, their only goal is to keep the eyeballs on there longer in order to get these people to watch the ads. So I do think something is definitely coming with data privacy. And I think the algorithms, there might be some kind of transparency provisions. Like, that's what's really unclear. Like, the warnings are always about the algorithms, but what do they do about it is very much a topic of conversation, and the suggestions are all over the map. So I don't know what, but that's what I've witnessed as the focus right now in these hearings.
Can I make a pitch for the idea that I don't believe that age restriction is the hurdle that you guys are suggesting that it might be? I think especially if you are looking at it from an OS level. So let's say that the federal law is that these certain apps need to be age restricted, and you cannot start an account until you're 18. If you look at the amount, now understanding that from Heaton's perspective, you are right. Just because you make a law saying that kids can't drink alcohol before a certain level or kids can't smoke cigarettes before a certain level, it does not mean that you will stop everybody. It certainly did not stop me or my friends from drinking or smoking before we were legally allowed to do it.
I've had 2 cigarettes, both over the age of 28.
He said, surprising no one.
No, I take that back. One of them was 22. I have 1 cigarette per decade.
If you look at it, I almost exclusively smoke cigarettes when I'm drunk and I know my friends are running low and I literally just want to waste them to be a dickhead. That's the only time that I've ever requested a cigarette from my friends, when I just want to waste their cigarettes. If you did it from an OS level and you pushed for it to say, hey, look, for your kid's phone, there is a way either through Android or iOS that you can say this app from an iOS level, from parental restrictions, which are only getting more and more pervasive on these operating systems, they cannot download these apps, and it would require a 14-year-old jailbreaking their phone. I think that could probably send an alert to the parent that has set this up. Then I do think that there are technological solutions to this if you wanted to age gate certain apps and you understand that kids overwhelmingly interact with these apps via mobile phones, mobile technology.
That's an interesting point. So if I'm understanding you right, Justin, we're with the premise that most kids are using iPhones and iPads, are not using laptops or going to internet cafes or whatever, which I think you're right about.
They don't have to worry if their mom is going to pick up the phone and you'll hear her voice over the modem, right?
Yeah. Then, noting this, you bake in some kind of age restriction on the phone itself, or you have some sort of data metric in there of when you sign up for the phone, you put in your birthday or whatever, and then that gets baked in, and now it, depending on how the feds set this up,
Parental Right to Data Act or something like that. I could very much see in a world that A, does all the things that Jen mentioned, because I do think that those are the elements that are more to the fore on it. But there's a lot of stuff that I read in this report that are triggers for both parties. And whenever I read a thing that echoes talking points that I've heard from both sides, that's the only time for which I ever dare to think the thought, oh, somebody might make a law. And beyond just they're trying to ram it over virulent opposition on one side or the other, it's the reason why I felt so bearish on TikTok's future, because there was just too much from both sides that were angry about it. And I don't think it's in the offing immediately, but as some of these companies seem to weaken a little bit, Meta is, we're in a tech winter right now. Maybe the lobbyist spend isn't quite what it used to be. Maybe the reputational element of this is something that these companies want. Maybe Google wants to say yes, and Apple wants to be on the forefront of, please buy your kids more iPhones and iPads and Android phones and Android tablets. You'll be able to feel safer with them because you will be able to gate what they do.
Well, and the other thing that Google and Facebook will invariably do, as happens with all of these industry regulations, is the giants will step up and say, hey, Congress, we, Facebook, want you to regulate our industry. We care about these kids. We are asking you, Congress, please regulate us. We would love to sit down at the table with you when you're coming up with regulations for our industry. We have a lot of good ideas, and then we'll come up with ways to fuck over any competitors or people that could ever conceivably come into the space. Google will absolutely try to do that because
Meta has been actively trying to do that since they were Facebook. Has been the ads on the newsletter, and the DC newsletter that everybody reads, like Politico and Punchbowl and stuff like that. They have spent heavily on those ads saying, isn't it about time we got new social media laws?
Right. Apps. And then what Google would do is, if I were Google, what I would say is, Jen makes a great point about the algorithm. The algorithms are very, very dangerous. Google would love to be involved in regulating the algorithms. You start looking into it, it might be an algorithm that severely punishes ChatGPT, the one thing Google's afraid of. That'll happen. If we do this, there's going to be regulatory capture or attempts thereof. That said, though, if Congress wanted to have a fairly simple law that said, based on this iPhone age gate technology that you referenced, Justin, that we're going to give, like, there have to be parental alerts from kids' phones to their parents, and the parents have, you know, more ability to restrict the time on apps or something like that. Like, that would, I would be okay with that if all you're doing is empowering parents.
You know, I think a lot of this conversation is revolving around the idea that parents are clamoring for a way to keep their kids off social media, and that this entire idea that this Surgeon General is going forth with, that like social media is like what's making teenagers depressed. I think we also have to maybe consider that people aren't buying it, because I mean, I have teenagers, so many in my lives. There are my nieces and nephews. I have 12, and many of them are teenagers. And like, none of their parents are trying to keep them off these apps. I know with my own social media use, like, it's not the social media itself that makes me depressed. It's the news I'm getting from it. It's finding out that an old high school friend died. It's finding out that the debt ceiling is going to be a problem again.
It's the reality that you're learning about, not the algorithm itself.
Literally, yeah. And like, there's a lot of people, a lot of kids especially, that when they go home every day, they go to social media to reconnect with their friends. So what I was doing when I was their age is I was picking up the telephone and I was calling them. My nieces are on Instagram and DMing each other. And so it's like the blaming of social media for teens having teen, you know, depression. I think it's kind of a scapegoat in a lot of ways, because we all felt that way. And I was a teenager in the 90s when we were told that the future is bright. And now these kids are being told that your future is fucked. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, if you look at the stats over the years, these teenagers would be more depressed than we were. And so when I look at like the clamoring of the parents, I feel like this is a conversation I only hear in Congress and in DC circles, because social media is the bugaboo. I'm just not feeling it like in real life.
I think that's a great point, Jen. Like, truly, that is a great point. And the one of the big issues with all of these conversations when we're getting into data in terms of, you know, kids are more depressed, you always have to be careful about causation and correlation. It's very difficult to parse these things out. The classic example in my life, when I was in high school, I remember there was a big thing about how red wine makes you healthy, because red wine drinkers live longer than everybody else. And like, I was like, and like, it was the wine industry loved it. It was like, you know, doing everything they could to promote this.
Carlo Rossi doing backflips.
Yeah. You start thinking about it and you're like, wait a minute, you're telling me red wine drinkers live longer than people that drink plastic jug vodka? That's amazing. Is there any other correlations you can think of? Might red wine drinkers have gym membership? Might they have healthcare? Oh, was red wine just a proxy for being rich? Yes, it is. Yes, rich people live longer than poor people. That kind of thing, right? It's not that red wine is the cause of the lifespan extension. It's just correlated with it. That's a big thing. The other thing I'll bring up is like, there's deductive logic and inductive logic, terms that I only learned this last year, even though I'd used them incorrectly in conversation regularly for years before that. Deductive logic is where you come up with a thesis and then you work it out in an abstract manner. You deduct from the starting position. Inductive logic is where you've got a group of data and you make an inference from it. You're using empirical data. Deductively, this feels right to me, what the Surgeon General is saying. Deductively, it's like, yeah, it seems to me that social media could be a big problem. If relying on inductive reasoning, I don't think you can make a very good case, because the data is pretty weak. When you start looking at depression rates amongst teenagers and things. Jonathan Haidt, who I have great respect for, I love Jonathan Haidt, wrote a piece about this recently, and he shared all of his data to his immense credit because he's a good academic. And you start going through the studies, and they'll say, like, you know, we found a 2% increase in depression amongst social media users. And there'll be like 20 different studies that find a 2% increase in depression amongst social media. 2% is not a high enough. Like, that's you're not outside of a false positive level with 2%. That's so small. Like, you could, if I went, there's a 2% people that eat ice cream on Tuesdays are 2% less likely to get struck by lightning or something like that. You go, yeah, that's probably just random. That's not that. If it were like 80%, we could say there's something going on there. But 2%, that's so low that it could just be noise. And so the data that I'm saying is not conclusive to the point where I would go, this is from an empirical standpoint, an existential threat to kids, et cetera, et cetera. I do feel that intuitively I feel that, but I will acknowledge that my feelings are not in sync with the data.
Yeah. Let me also draw a line here that when we talk about social media, and this is, I blanch a little bit whenever we talk about the algorithms, because I think that algorithms get a bad rap for being these evil ghosts in the machine that are infecting the goodness that could be our connectivity online. In reality, algorithms are, at least on all these apps that we are talking about, designed to do things for which they will always be designed to do. Maximize time spent on the app, which maximizes real estate for which you can sell advertising against. That's it. And that's all, unless we want to say you're not allowed to do that. You are not allowed to maximize the real estate for which you can sell advertising, which I think would be a thornier issue in terms of regulating social media. Then we can ask for algorithm transparency all we want, and we're going to see that same solution played out each and every single time. We might see different stuff when it comes to moderation, and that's what happened with like the Twitter algorithm when Twitter put that out there. But by and large, it's the same story each and every time. The reality of what the critics of this would be, and I agree with you, Heaton, for me and you, Jen, I don't know exactly how much of this is the same arguments that we were probably hearing about, or our parents were hearing about MTV when we were kids.
Yeah, or video games
that this is the new thing, that's the reason why the kids are not great. But I do think that there is some element of differentiating between the advertising driven world of social media. And that's what I would define as Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and the messaging and community side of social media, Discord, Snapchat's messaging, Instagram's DMs or Facebook Messenger. That stuff, I do think you can monetize on a level that is not about feeding certain kinds of content that has been proven to keep people on it, for which can be doomer stuff. You know, it turns out if it bleeds, it leads wasn't just for television. It's for social media as well. If you get mad, you stay where you are until you can try and fix the problem. And that is a very, very effective way that these apps keep people on there and keep showing them ads.
They're kind of like, I mean, they're kind of like markets to some extent. Like what markets do is they give you a lot of what you actually want. They're big conveyor belts. So if you really want porn more than Bibles, markets are going to give you a lot of porn. They're going to give you the thing that you are craving.
That's why I find it in the hotel.
That's why you find Playboys. Playboys in the and algorithms are doing the same thing. Algorithms are going, what do you actually want? What do you actually like? What gets you going? Not what you want to want, by the way. This is a crucial distinction. Markets and algorithms don't give you what you want to want. If you sit down and go, I would like to be the kind of person that reads articles about charity and listens to classical music, and you always click on the clickbait and you always click on the partisan anger and things like that, it's gonna give you the thing that you want. So it's going to be inflammatory, it leads to all that stuff, which brings me to my thing is, I think the way that ultimately we're going to deal with this weird new technology is just by becoming used to it and developing our own methods of personally interacting with it. I'm actually kind of surprised that we don't have stronger etiquette at this point with, say, like mobile phones. I thought back like 10, 15 years ago, I thought we were going to develop kind of a cultural etiquette of you just don't take your phone out at dinner, or everybody puts their phone on the table and whoever texts first has to get the tip or something like that. Or maybe like, I have friends that for a while,
when people should be less boring. I wouldn't take my phone out all the goddamn. Step your game up, mom.
Or the other bit too is, like, I feel like when we have dinner, when we hang out, we're not like we're all paying attention to each other, but it might be like, oh, that reminds me of this funny video. And so the phone is, you know, so there's good reasons for that. Whereas I have other friends that, you know, they're just constantly, they're only half there. Or like I had friends for a while that when you entered their home, they had like a bucket or a hat you put your phone in, and they were like, you're welcome to use your phone, but we're going to ask you only use it near the door. Please don't use your phone. And so we would rather you just be engaged with us while you're in our home. I'm surprised that stuff hasn't happened more, but I think eventually that kind of thing will happen where, like, I don't know, like I was much more engaged on Facebook up until about 2012. And then I was like, this is just me losing friendships and fighting with people. And like, I kind of disengaged from it, and I haven't really ever been involved in Facebook since then. Like, Twitter, I've you know, I'm on it, but reluctantly. And I don't know. I think trying to regulate away human nature is going to be a fool's errand if that's what we're trying to do with modifying algorithms to be healthier. But being able to kind of acknowledge, maybe we shouldn't smoke as much, maybe we shouldn't, you know, binge on Cheetos as much, and kind of carry that over to the digital world and go, maybe I just shouldn't look at doom porn all day. That's going to be where the change comes from.
Jen, any final thoughts on this?
Well, the one thing I would like to see legislated is I would like the phones to lose their legal ability to basically spy on us. Because one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, if you have your phone in your pocket and you're having a conversation with someone, all of a sudden you get ads related to that. Like, I'm pissed off right now because, I mean, not pissed off. I'm not, you know, trying to have a baby, but I was talking to a friend about fertility. And I don't want to have kids. And yet Instagram, even though this was all offline, keeps feeding me like, if you're over 40 and trying to get pregnant, I'm like, fuck off, I'm not. But like the only way that they could possibly be targeting me,
Jen,
for that.
You are over 40. I was at your birthday, Jen. You're now 40 years old. You need to accept it.
Jen, the elderly Jen, part, I've accepted.
No. No, they don't need to listen to you. We're not as unpredictable as we think. And also, when you plug your friends into the social graph, your friends searching for a thing and you being close to them and in that demo is the reason why you are getting those ads.
Exactly. And so for me, it's the tracking. And when I think of like the kids, I think if it's harmful for adults, it's also harmful to kids. So to limit their ability to track us and the targeted ads and stuff like that, like that's the part of what I'm hearing in Congress that I'm excited about, because I do hear them in tune with these concerns that I think some of us have. But as for like stopping teenagers from using social media, I think Andrew's right. I mean, I look at the habits that, you know, one of my cousins, she's 18, and she'll post something on Instagram, like an actual post, and then a couple days later, take it down. And so all of these years, she has like 7 photos, and a bunch of her friends are like that. It's amazing. Like they're just developing strategies on their own, because they've grown up with this stuff. Like, we were the ones that had, you know, internet-free childhoods, and we're trying to figure out how to deal with it. Gen Z is already figuring it out without Congress getting involved. So, I think they need do big legislation that helps us all, but not, you know, stop kids from using it. I don't think that helps. Especially, like, you know, we have this war on trans kids right now. And I think it would be horrible for them to not have social media for them to connect with each other. So there would be harms in limiting them also. Like, I think we have to think of all the consequences. So, end of rant.
I do feel sorry for the kids that went through high school right when Facebook came out. Like, I do think they got just completely walloped by it. Like, when I was in high school, on Fridays, my senior year, my friends and I would play Dungeons and Dragons. And then we'd go to Lake Hefner and shine spotlights at parked cars. And then the people that were banging in the cars would get mad and chase us. And that was a really funny Friday. And because we weren't on social media, there were, I'm sure that there were like field parties and things happening. I found out recently some of the students in my class were actually having sex. And I didn't know about any of this while I was going on in high school. And so we would like find out a week later there was a party. We didn't care by then. Like, oh, somebody had a party at Tyler's house. Okay, all right, whatever, right? Whereas for the people that had social media, like right when it came out, right when they were in high school, I feel like they got stuck with these glitches in human nature that no one had really thought about before, like fear of missing out. You could be invited to three parties, and you're aware that even if you go to one of the parties, that you're missing out on the other two. There's no way around that. That's just how reality works. You can't be at three parties simultaneously, but you're missing out on two of the parties. And
Not with that attitude.
I'm fine, right? If I get invited to one, I'm having a great time. I was playing D&D, chasing cars in high school. But I do think that like for people that immediately had that and just had no prep for it, I think that probably did things. I do want to throw a question at you guys. None of us have kids, but I recently did a gender reveal party in a comedy sketch here in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. which is the closest.
With your fake wife?
With my fake wife. Which is, you know, the closest I've come to fatherhood and marital bliss, and got me thinking on what we would do with our fake child when it was up. Like, I think, like, if I had kids, I think I would have, like, a certain amount of screen time you were allowed to have. Now, I say that now. I don't know if I actually had kids, whether everything's out the window in reality, right? But at the moment, I think I would probably go, it's fine, but I don't want you going on certain websites, and we're going to put in screen time. You get to use, you know, if you're under 10, you get to use the iPad for an hour a day or something like that. I don't know. Do either of you have anything like that?
I would say the closest I come to is like Jen being in, having nephews and nieces. And so the biggest thing that I know is that whenever I say the phrase Roblox in front of my nephew, who is not allowed to have it, and in front of my brother, who is desperate to keep an iPad with Roblox out of his son's hands, there is a crazed mania for which my brother knows he can only keep at bay for so long. And they're going to come visit in July, hopefully, at which point the house will be littered with tablets with Roblox on it. And I will just be entering his credit card, my brother's credit card, onto all of them with no restrictions.
What is Roblox? Is that like Minecraft?
Basically, it's Minecraft, like a Minecraft Fortnite-y thing, but you can build games in it. And oh, wow. So you can, well, it's
teaching kids to code games. That seems like a great thing.
Coding, you put quotes around coding, but like, there is still a market for it, and the market runs on Robux. So there is a great danger for somebody at the age that my nephew is, of just all of a sudden doing what for us in our youth would have been, you know, calling the 1-900 number to find out why Hulk Hogan hates earthquake. And mm-hmm. and all of a sudden $100 bill showing up on the phone bill, and your mom or dad being very upset about it.
There was this great show when I was in college that was like the local public access show that was the greatest scam of the world. Like they had this hot British lady that would go, you know, call in and you could win $100. This next question is it would be like a really, really basic question, like, Washington, D.C. is next to which state, Virginia or Washington State? And then they would just like talk for a minute. They're like, and then they have people call in and pretend to get it wrong. And people go like, Idaho? And she's like, no, it's not Idaho. And remember, it's only $10 a minute to call in, but you can win $100. And they would just have like this cast of characters be dumb fucks. And then you're watching this at home going, how is no one getting this? I should call in and get this $100. Then eventually you realize, oh, this is a brilliant scam. And that man was George Santos.
That's pretty good. To answer your question, I think I would monitor the social media, but one thing that I certainly wouldn't do is prevent kids from having access to it, because just witnessing some children interactions, the ones that aren't allowed to use social media at all or the internet at all turn out to be weirdos. Like, you don't want to block the kids out from what everyone else is talking about. And I think it's almost cruel to be that parent that's like, I'm so evolved that I don't let my kids do anything digital. And then, you know, they don't have the social skills to, like, when we were kids, we needed to know about the latest movie. You know, you had to go to school having watched Jurassic Park, or like, you would not be in the know. Everything for these kids is on the internet. So I think just monitoring it, making sure they're not getting catfished by pedophiles, like, you know, you can stay in your kid's life and know who they're talking to without cutting them off from the internet. And I think the ultimate solution really is parents just being in their kids' lives and knowing what's up. Like, I just don't think Congress can make these decisions for everyone.
With all that being said, I would greatly encourage parents to email us about this, because no matter what our opinions and how sure of them we are not in the fight as you guys are. So
parents love getting
wrong.
Parenting advice from non-parents, right? Because it's fresh, oh, it's a new perspective. They love hearing like confident parenting opinions. Yeah. We don't know what we're doing. Nobody be mad. Definitely write into Justin. I don't have to filter any of this.
I don't know what I'm doing as a parent, but I still identify as a teenager. Like, all of my answers are always from the perspective of the kids, and I think always will be. So.
And when I was a kid, I felt like I was 40. And like right now, Jen, when you're like, you don't want to cut kids out of it. I was like, oh my God, I got to make sure the kids don't turn into me. Jesus Christ, kids, go on social media. You don't want to be heating when you grow up. You need to figure out what the kids are talking about.
I could just imagine the 1-900 number that really got Heaton to run up the $200 bill is just that British lady saying, are you a well-mannered young boy? Are you a very, very good rule follower? The new rule is call this number. Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you need to go to support this program. Marching our way to 900 patrons. We have crossed the halfway mark, the 50-yard line, as it were. So we are moving into the red zone for our final battle before summiting Mount 1000. But you get something for your money, by the way, patreon.com/we're not wrong. And that is a bonus topic. You don't just get the two topics. You get three topics each and every week. And this week, we'll be talking about the highest and lowest rated brands in America, according to a new Harris Axios poll. I'll tell you, Patagonia's number one, and FTX is somewhere at the bottom. Actually, no, I believe the Trump Organization is at the bottom, which I think is kind of a cheap shot, because they're like a business in the way that, you know, a dog groomer is a business. They don't exactly have an expansive clientele, but go ahead and subscribe. We are going to give our personal opinions on all this. Let's go ahead and talk about the debt ceiling obliquely, but I want to pivot this to something more broad. With the deadline on that debt ceiling drawing near, there is an increasing sentiment amongst the Republican Congress. Why? Specifically, why is the deadline set by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on June 1st? And can it be trusted as accurate as the real drop-dead date as to when the United States will run out of money to pay its bills? Some right-wing representatives believe that this is a strategy by the Biden administration to pressure Republicans into giving in to their demands for a debt limit increase. This disbelief is spearheaded by influential figures such as Representative Matt Gaetz and Representative Ralph Norman, who have both suggested a need to scrutinize the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's justification for the established deadline, with the specific claim that she should show her work, even if it means being called and compelled to testify. The doubt is not solely limited to the party's right flank, however. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Patrick McHenry, who is one of the key figures involved in the debt limit negotiations with the White House, has also expressed skepticism about the urgency of the White House to reach a deal. McHenry stated that unless the Treasury could provide adequate reasoning for the June 1st date and the White House team exhibited an urgency toward these negotiations, it was fair to question the legitimacy of the proposed deadline. Matt Gaetz also said that Janet Yellen was the Obi-Wan Kenobi of wrong ideas, which made me question whether or not Matt Gaetz has seen Star Wars. Is there a crisis of confidence in the divide between the politics of the White House and the jobs of officials like Yellen? Or is this a one-off gripe from the negotiating table congressional expert, Jen Briney?
I mean, I think, of course, there's skepticism in everything that's coming out of the mouths of everyone involved in this debt ceiling debacle. And when it comes to Janet Yellen, I mean, she was a presidential appointee. And I think just the nature of being appointed by a political figure, like, people are going to have their doubts, especially if they're on the other side of the aisle. I don't think it's an easy job to go to all government departments and being like, how much money do you have left, and like pick a specific date. I think that this is a task that she shouldn't even have to deal with, because the debt ceiling, the more I think about it, like, we had that whole 14th Amendment conversation. Like, I think the debt ceiling itself is probably unconstitutional. So I'm actually rooting for a constitutional crisis on this at this point, because this just shouldn't be a thing. And so for Janet Yellen to, you know, be having to deal with these morons like Matt Gaetz, who are just like, oh, the date's wrong. It's like, yeah, that's the point. That's what we need to be fighting about here, not the existence of the debt ceiling or whether or not this is wise, or like, no, it's the date. So I think it's a stupid thing to focus on. But yeah, I think that there's justifiable reasons that no one is trusted in this. We've seen this type of brinksmanship happen over and over again. I think there's a lack of trust in our government in general right now, which is, I mean, one of the things I'm finding so stunning about this year's debt ceiling crisis, knowing that we're having this conversation at the end of May and they're saying the drop dead deadline is June 1st, is that in the past, there was a much bigger sense of panic in the country about it. And I think we're just so numb to these types of manufactured crises that Americans just don't even care anymore. We don't believe anyone. So I think we're in a really sad place where we don't know who to trust. We don't know who's acting in good faith. And yeah. And I don't think Matt Gaetz is acting in good faith when he says this to Janet Yellen, just to be clear, like, that's, the date is not the point. The point is that this is happening. So whether it's June 1st or 5th or 15th, like, who cares? This still needs to get solved. But yeah, it's a lot of bad faith actors accusing other people of acting in bad faith. It's a nasty thing to witness.
Heaton, do you believe that there is a problem with not being able to trust, while politically appointed, secretaries of the federal government? They are still people for whom probably should carry a little bit of credibility. Do you think that there has been a steady erosion in our trust in these officials, or has it always been something that we've looked at askance?
This is something that I haven't quite reconciled in my mind yet. I think it's very healthy to be skeptical of people in power in general, and including people in power being skeptical of each other. I think that's also a good thing. It makes total sense to me that Congress would, at any point, want to bring in a Secretary of the Treasury and go, show us your work. I think that's very legitimate, by the way, for Congress, that is setting the budget, that is raising the taxes, that's spending the money, for Congress, which is the actual organization that's vested with the running the finances of the country. They're the board of the directors for the finances of the country. Makes total sense to me that they would ask the Treasury Secretary to come in and explain, where are you getting these numbers from? We want to see your work. I think that's completely legitimate, and I don't think that any secretary of cabinet level secretary should just be able to say, I'm above you. You know, do not question my work. 100%. The overall question of trust, though, Justin, I kind of go back and forth on this, because you need to have a lot of trust in society as a whole for society to work well and be good. Societies that have high social trust tend to be nice places to live. Places with very low social trust tend to not be great places to live. Like, I would not want to live in a country where I had so little faith in waiters that I refused to, like, they refused to give me my food until I showed them my money. And I, right now, you know, they bring you the food and they don't think you're going to walk out of the restaurant. They know that you're going to stick around and pay for it. And I was worried about that, right? I wouldn't want to live in something like that. But at the same time, a lot of the social trust that we've had eroded in the country over the last 20, 30 years has been institutional social trust, which I think is largely deserved. It's looking at media and going, Yeah, these organizations keep lying to us a lot, and they have been. There's, you know, going back to the Spanish-American War, going through the Iraqi War. These are groups that routinely have interest. Same thing with political institutions going, oh, wait a minute. Like you go back to like, when I was in high school, people would say things like, you know, I don't like the president, but I believe in the presidency. I respect the institution of the presidency. I just don't respect the man in it. And I'm like, I don't really think you should do either. I think you should always be skeptical of people that can take your money or kill folks. That is something that you shouldn't just drape in a mantle of respectability. It's something that you should view as a very dangerous loaded gun pointed at a bunch of people. I don't know. Just I'm still trying to work this out in my head of is it a good thing that we're having plummeting social trust, or is it just reality that previously we were kind of naive and we just assumed that all of these large institutions and media, education, and politics always had our best interests at heart, and we're finally realizing that they are much more insular and self-serving than we had hitherto recognized.
Well, it's not the institutions, right? It's the people that are running them. So you could have a situation where we trust every institution, where we trust the media, where we trust the government, if there were people running them who we trusted. So I think we have to keep in mind that these institutions, they don't just, you know, run themselves. There's human beings that we don't trust. And so when it comes to Janet Yellen, I mean, she was next to Alan Greenspan that whole time. She was next to Ben Bernanke. She's one of them. And so when you look at the history of the last two decades, when it comes to financial things and just a whole mountain of bullshit, like she was right there. So it's like, when I look at her particular position right now, I'm looking at her. I'm looking at Janet Yellen, you know, and I think, and that goes for all of them. It goes for Joe Biden. He has been in the Senate since 20 years before I was born. So it's like we have records of these individuals, and I think their records are one of the reasons why the institutions are losing trust, because these same people have been in charge for so long and we've seen so many crises. I mean, we are just reliving an old crisis from, you know, 2012, 2013. It's always when a Democrat isn't the president, but this whole debt ceiling thing keeps happening over and over again. It's like a bad movie we keep seeing, but the players are the same. So I think that we need to focus more on the individuals than the institutions, because the institutions themselves are not, you know, they're not things worthy of trust or distrust. It's the people that we're entrusting them to.
Well, yeah, I think that the one thing that I would say with this administration specifically, at least compared to the last one, is that the Trump administration was so chaotic that if you looked at the media response to it, it was either any decision that was looked at as unpopular by the media was a fiat by Donald Trump to do X, Y, or Z. Any decision that went against what Donald Trump would want, A, we would know Donald Trump was pissed because he would tweet about it. And two, it would be looked at as, oh, this is, thank God somebody is standing up. Thank God somebody is doing their job. They were looked at as more independent. But there was a chaos there. There was a push and pull that was transparent, mostly because the president was terminally online and showing his butt throughout the entire process. With the Biden administration, and we've joked about it on this show, they are thick. Like, they never get fired. They will always come back. They will always get a new job. You cannot be humiliated hard enough. The fact that they went through that debacle in Afghanistan without top people from the Pentagon or the State Department getting canned, that I feel like in any other administration, somebody would have had to fall on the sword and say, well, that was Doug's fault. Doug's the one who said, let's do it sloppy. And we didn't know until the 11th hour. But no, they just said, we have everything under control. They obviously didn't. It's obviously been a fiasco. Ironically, we've actually seen them seemingly do a good job on the border now, post Title 42, by essentially putting in a lot of the same stuff that was in there during the Trump administration. But they finally came to that realization that there had to be something else done. But prior to that, for the last 3 years, we have not seen that, or the last 2.5 years, we've not seen that. It has been an absolute fiasco down there, and we still have the exact same people. They are tight. The Biden administration, like it does not change over fast and it does not change over easy. So I can understand as we get to the home stretch of this particular 4-year term that throughout all of it, it's like, okay, well, I don't particularly think that there would be a consequence if Janet Yellen were being a little bit more political than anything else. Because initially she said that this drop dead date was possibly in July and it got moved up. And so, you know, I have to give a shrug emoji because I do know that at least as far as I've seen with this administration, they've been pretty lockstep. They follow the same playbook.
Well, and on top of that too, like this is a negotiation, right? And both sides are going to be using leverage to negotiate however best they can.
Yes.
The Republicans and Democrats both have a card they can play. One of the cards is maybe we're crazy. Maybe we're crazy. That's what the Republicans are doing. Right? Maybe we'll tiptoe up to the default and everything will become very expensive. One of the cards that the administration can play is this is going to happen a lot faster than it might actually really happen because we want to try to buy ourselves time to get this thing settled. I have no way of knowing any of this. As just somebody on the outside, I mean, the actual date of when the apocalypse happens.
Even if the accusation is true, right? And yeah. Janet Yellen is pretending that the deadline is 6 weeks before it actually is. That could also be a move to protect the damn country from Republican brinksmanship. To like, you know, we have friends that are late to everything. And so we tell them that the actual time we're meeting is an hour before, just knowing how they're going to be. And so this might be Janet Yellen buying us some time because the Republicans are being, you know, shockingly irresponsible with our finances, despite screaming that they care about the debt. So even if she is lying, it's one of those where I'm like, I don't care. I think it's probably a good move.
It's good for us. It's the government lying to us for our own good.
Yeah, a noble lie.
Well, I mean, it's not really lying to us, right? It's lying to the Republicans to get them to actually start negotiating in good faith instead of waiting until the actual deadline and defaulting. Is that what we want here? Do we want to actually default and bring this right to the deadline
The Republican argument for this is that they wanted to be negotiating months ago and Biden refused to do it.
Well, I mean, this shouldn't, again, like they said they weren't going to negotiate with the terrorists and they are. So it's like if your actual position is like, no, this isn't where the budget discussion is supposed to happen. We have a budget process and the debt ceiling is not related to it at all. That is a position they could have stuck with. Instead, Biden said, we're not negotiating with the terrorists. And now he's negotiating with the terrorists. So it's a terrible policy on their part to like say a thing and then not do the thing. But the point is that this is a completely unnecessary crisis. There is one party who is doing this. It is the Republicans, and it's repeatedly the Republicans. The debt ceiling was raised three times with no problem whatsoever during the Trump administration. So let's not pretend that this is actually some kind of noble fight that they're having. It's not. And so if Janet Yellen, like, I don't like the government or government officials, I should say, because the government itself can't lie, but I don't like lies. But at the same time, when you're dealing with childish antics like we are right now, if Yellen is giving us some buffer room in these negotiations to hopefully not default, if they're going to bring us to the brink, to tell us that the brink is a little bit earlier, this is one of those that I'm going to forgive.
All right.
How would they have refrained from negotiating with the Republicans?
They would have said, we're not negotiating on this. Like, we can have a budget debate, but you raise the ceiling and then we do that. Like, that's what they said they were going to do. They said they were not going to negotiate the debt ceiling.
But don't the Republicans have to sign off on it, though? I mean, by this, I mean the House. Like, how could the president just say we're not going to negotiate with the House?
I don't know.
We can ignore the House.
I don't know why they said that. I don't know why the Democrats, when they had control of the entire government, didn't get rid of the debt ceiling forever. So it's like, I don't understand the strategy in any of this. I think the Democrats have been incredibly stupid in allowing the debt ceiling to exist. So it's like when Biden said he's not going to negotiate, how is that practical? I don't know, but that is what he said. So to then go back on
because the Democrats use it too. They just use it for different reasons, and they don't. They try to extract smaller things. There's a reason why Trump said yes. There's a reason why Donald Trump was chiding Pelosi and Schumer for talking about the debt ceiling when he was president. And now he's like, oh, well, we should run it up to default. And when asked about his hypocrisy, said, well, I was the president then. I'm not the president now. Like this is a useful crisis for which everybody can use. Now, the Democrats do not push it in the way that the Republicans do, because the Republicans Never. Have a backbone in the idea of the debt. But this is nothing gets done unless there's urgency.
There's a difference between having a backbone and being reckless with our country's finances. This is not, you know, sure. a good strategy for the Republicans.
I'm saying that the lore of their party is such. I'm not saying that it's morally right.
Okay.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. There's an email ceiling coming, and the only way to lift it is to keep sending us emails. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Oh no, writes, this show is a perfect example of why politics are so difficult to talk about. We have three friends who respect and care for one another and assume good faith on the part of their interlocutor, even as they disagree. And up comes a 15-minute conversation about the efficacy of the stock market as a barometer of the U.S. economy as a whole. If the three of you, and I'm a huge fan of all of you, can find yourself down that rabbit hole, what chance do the rest of us have?
Well, this is why you have us. We all have no chance, but we will have tough conversations for you.
You should not have arguments. You should all be docile cows that move from pasture to pasture, and you should leave arguments to the professionals like us, which I am now proposing should be licensed by the federal government so we can regulatory capture the concept of arguments for money.
It would be great. By the way, if there were podcast licensing, that would be terrific for those of us that are already in podcasting. If we could do something like that.
Go poke around with the house. Just do a whisper around the water cooler while you're still up in DC. Mm-hmm.
Yep. What about podcast licensing? Wouldn't that be a way to protect children?
Wouldn't that be a way for them to de-license us and be like, oh, no. Like, you don't work for CNN or Fox. Like, you don't get a license. Oh, yeah.
For the record, I'm being farcical. This is the worst thing in the world that could happen if Congress decided who gets to do podcasts.
Yeah. And despite a decade.
Occupational licensing's mostly bad.
Despite a decade, they would just be like, oh, no, you're not worthy, Jim Bray. There's no chance.
This guy writes, please stop referring to the work of generative models like ChatGPT and DALL-E as AI. These things are not intelligent, as demonstrated by the highly intelligent Lord Uncle Heaton on his generated show. These models, while nifty, are purely reactive and do not create ex nihilo. They require input and prompts in order to do what they do. They do not learn or have any memory built in within the very narrow confines of their prompt. They have learned in a strictly statistical sense from a multi-billion word corpora the possibilities associated with the words and phrases on the internet, but they do not learn except when they get retrained. They are little more than fancy circuit boards.
Hey, I'm with you, but I think the cow has left the barn on that one. I'm in agreement. It's AI is a poor phrase for this. When people in science fiction, when we used to talk about AI, what we really meant was artificial sentience and a machine that could think and have its own willpower. That's not what we're dealing with. But I mean, literally in the example you gave, the company is OpenAI. AI is built into the name of the company. So while I'm in agreement with you, I don't think this is a battle we're going to win at this point. I think we just kind of have to accept that.
The M is machine. Why is it called ATM machine? Look, sorry, dude. Language is evolving, and sometimes you got to take the L.
Well, and I don't know what alternative was offered here.
Generative large language models. Generative large language models that tends to be what you want to say. That is probably a more technically specific.
No, you need to redefine the acronyms. Keep the AI, but just change what the A and the I mean. That way we can all keep saying AI and then be like, when you say AI, oh, I mean algorithmic initiative or whatever the thing is.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's very clearly that these computer programs that you have to use a browser for aren't Allen Iverson. Gainesville writes, what are your thoughts on wealthy folks using the unrealized gains of their stock as collateral for loans, effectively letting them realize their gains without paying taxes? Heaton, you look like you're rich. Defend this.
I look like I'm rich because I'm good at branding and creating sketch characters. I am not rich. So let's back up and kind of put what we're talking about out there. So we're talking about unrealized gains, right? So we're talking about like somebody gets stock options or they have stock. You purchase an index fund for $100 and it's worth $400 in a couple of years, and you've not paid taxes on that. Well, that's probably the best way to do this. You're not going to pay taxes on things until the point of sale, which is how you want to do this. Like if I were a CEO and I'm being paid in stock options and I get the stock options year one and I am then paying taxes on the stock then, and then they expand, you know, they triple in value and I don't pay on it because I've already paid the stock options, then you're really getting away with murder, right? So if you're going to have assets that are existent other than just wages, which we're going to do, you're going to have unrealized gains, and you eventually do pay for those gains at the point of sale. Having somebody use that for collateral in the meantime doesn't really bother me. In the same way that theoretically, if you wanted to have your car or your house be collateral for something, you're basically saying, I have this thing that you can take if I'm unable to pay my debt. And when you sell the thing, when you sell the house, when you sell the car, then you pay capital gains tax on it and you're taxed at that point. And we can have a conversation about what capital gains rate should be at, but I don't see an easy, good way around this. So yeah, it doesn't really bother me.
Jen, anything on this?
No, I mean, it's an advantage, but like Andrew said, like, I don't know what we do about it. It is what it is. It's an asset. So like any other asset, you can get a loan based on it. Like it's not something that like upsets me.
Political Prop writes, Friday, 2 p.m., upper management says, hey, Tuesday morning, governor is coming in to sign two bills. We need people for photo ops. You will be in these photos. The governor walks in, immediately hits the mic, blah, 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 jerk off, say name, say name, say name, pass off to representative, rinse and repeat, pass off, rinse and repeat, sign, picture, does it again, down for the second bill, picture, picture. Okay, now my management gets their pictures while shaking hands and walking down the line very, very fast. Weak handshake, by the way. Shotgun tour out the door. Politicians are dogs who need to cockfight to get you in a booth and click their button. If they don't convince you that they are the best, then don't vote blindly.
Great point, listener.
Yes, I agree. Jen's biggest fan writes, Professor Dorothy Brown has great policy recommendations for improving the tax code to be more fair for everybody. She would get rid of deductions and all exclusions, with the exception of a single refundable living allowance deduction. She would maintain a progressive structure and get rid of the preferred tax rate for capital gains. I like this approach because it would really simplify our insane tax code. Also, the current code is way easier for affluent people to exploit, since most deductions favor the wealthy. Homeowners, people with major investments, people who live in high tax areas. It would also guarantee a minimum yearly income through that refundable credit.
You know what? That sounds good to me. I would like there to be a more simplified tax code. I don't like the idea of using the tax code as a giant social engineering mechanism to try and promote one thing and downplay another thing. I think you should keep it simple. You also bring up a very good point that the more complicated government regulation gets, the more it is abused by the people that have the resources to sidestep those regulations or find the loopholes in it. If you want to have a big Rube Goldberg regulatory state, the people that are going to benefit from it most are the people that can employ staffs of lawyers and accountants to find loopholes. So if you can slim it down and make it much more streamlined, I think that would be to the benefit of everybody, and you would find that it would be less advantageous to the people at the top.
If you take away my deductions, I will storm the Capitol. Just one more writes, Justin once compared boomers watching Fox News. I will add this editorially, cable news. Nobody gets spared when it comes to cable news, to fentanyl addiction. And I am here to state that in my own personal experience with my father on the Murdoch Express and a brother walking with Dr. Feelgood, the drug addict is indeed the preferable person to deal with. Look at that. A little field reporting. A Heaton listener, since I was 14 and now just a regular working adult, because Heaton is an ancient old man, writes, in response to Jen's claim that, quote, the difference between revenue and expenses works most of the time for valuing other companies. Profit is a useful metric, but value is subjective and different actors have different time frames, earning expectations, risk tolerances. My local barbershop would be valued more than SpaceX, according to this framework. Finance is a quantitative field, and it always surprises me when otherwise smart people, and Jen, I consider a queen, confidently claims that trading floors are basically the Wizard of Oz. Retail traders do get hosed for a reason. It's not just that the system is rigged.
Well said, listener. I am proud of you. Your victories are my victories.
I didn't say it was the Wizard of Oz. I said it was a casino.
There we go. So, update your metaphor, youngin. The Durham Report, really? Writes, you spent all that time and you did not once mention the high-speed chase involving Harry and Meghan. Don't you guys know how to news?
Were they chasing paparazzi? What were they chasing?
They were being chased by paparazzi. Jen, do you have an update on this?
I don't. I don't understand what they are complaining about. I don't understand why they don't just let people take the damn picture. Like, they're all dressed up. You went out to a thing in New York. Like, let the paparazzi have the picture, and then you don't have to drive really fast to get away from them. So I don't know. I think it's weird.
I think there is a fundamental difference beyond culture. I mean, legal, that Harry and Meghan have to understand between press freedoms in the UK versus press freedoms in America. They do not have the same laws over there that we have over here. We're Not Wrong is the production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Jen, what do you got heating up on the dish?
So this weekend I'll be releasing an episode about the East Palestine train derailment. There have been, I think, like 4 or 5 hearings. I watched them all. So I now know what caused it. I know what didn't. There was a lot of things that, you know, people were saying were factors that weren't. Got updates on the cleanup, what Norfolk Southern is and is not doing. Yeah, so I'm giving you all the highlights. I don't know if what we heard is true, but you're going to know what Congress is being told. And that will be released this weekend on Memorial Day weekend.
Cool beans. And Mr. Heaton, you've got a monster episode on the debt. What is that about?
I have an epic episode on the political orphanage this week. I have undertaken the task of making the most entertaining show about the national debt ever made. And I believe I have accomplished that, having sifted through quite a few white papers, quite a few articles and graphs and a handful of podcasts. I believe if you want to know why the debt is important, what the national debt is, the difference between the deficit, the debt, when the chickens come home to roost, what we need to worry about, what fiscal doom looks like, what happens if we default, all that stuff is on the political orphanage, and it kicks off with a really grisly story involving crucifixions, maiming, and swearing. Because again, I have taken these complex economic concepts stretching from Alexander Hamilton to now, and I have added a lot of entertainment value to it. So if you are interested in the debt, you want to know what's happening, you want to understand the underlying tectonic mechanisms, the deep stuff that the current fight we're having about the debt ceiling is taking place above, the stuff that's the fundamentals that are speaking to that flashpoint that we're having, to where you know what is going on and you know why it's important, please check out The Political Orphanage this week.
Did Walter Cronkite make the cut?
He is definitely in there. Walter Cronkite's in there. Thank you very much.
Nice. Nice. On PX3. Oh, baby, we're heating up. We have the Ron DeSantis announcement, which by the time that you listen to this will have already happened on Wednesday. Tim Scott announced on Monday. We preview the DeSantis stuff on the current episode of PX3 and review Tim Scott's theory of the case. On our Patreon, we will have a look at the DeSantis rollout. And on Friday's edition, as Jen mentioned, if you feel deja vu about this debt ceiling, it's because we went through it before. And I'm going to take a look back the last time that the debt ceiling was a big issue. What were the issues in the underlying? Who were the players? And how did it resolve? That's all on politics, politics, politics. But that wraps it up for us here. If you're a free listener, because we've already done our two topics and our emails. If you are a patron, there's another episode in your feed right now. It's marked bonus. You get to listen to it immediately following. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. Till then, friends, your old pal Justin Robert Young saying politics. Oh, fuck. I fucked it up. We're not wrong. I got lost in the sauce.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.